for him to walk in.
But I didn't know.
It appears to be the backup. Eric Coates, check.
Indeed. All right, it is 11, what time is it? It's 11:49, and we will start the Education Committee meeting. Second thing on the agenda is approval of the minutes from the March 2nd, 2020 meeting.
Motion to approve.
Second.
All right, we have a motion to approve and a second. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All right, motion carries. Up next, we have public comments. I think there are several people from the public here to make a comment. Just a reminder that public comments are limited to 2 minutes. And at the beginning, if you will please say your name and your address for the record. Also, just a reminder that public comments are not like question and answer. But I know we have our representatives from the school district here today. So if you have particular questions, you certainly can ask them during public comments and we will make note of them. So that way we can make sure during the discussion that those questions are hopefully that they're asked and answered. All right. So there's no sign up list. So if you'll just raise your hand, if you'd like to come up, we can come one at a time. Mr. Maurer.
Good morning, everybody. My name is Matt Maurer. I live at 927 Lansing Drive. And when we have an opportunity to interact during the presentation from the school district or not, will there be a Q&A time at that point or?
No, I mean, we will be able to ask questions, but not not the audience. But like I say, if you have any questions now, you feel free to go and ask them and we can write them down to make sure we get to them. Yeah.
I guess I'd like to impress upon the members of the school district that are here the importance of getting the children back to school. A lot of us are in dual income houses, as you guys know. My wife, myself, we've been essential workers since March 14th or 16th, excuse me, when school was out. She's a 21-year employee at MUSC. She was told, you take a 25% pay cut, work whenever we tell you, or you're going to be laid off. It's a very aggressive approach. But we don't have options. We know you recognize that. We appreciate that. We appreciate what you do. But we don't have options. And the kids are the ones. I have twin fifth graders. And online education was a disaster last year, which is fine because it was new to everybody. No judgment there. But we've got to get them back at school. They cry at night. They don't want to be at home. I can't get that through. We 64% of the people selected to go back to school. Let's safe start. If it's the 21st of September, that's great, but let's put together a plan and stick with that plan so that we as parents can make our arrangements. I've got 4 people coming to my house in the next 2 weeks to teach my kids, because that's all I can find. Please put a plan together, stick with it, and then let us work around it. That's what we ask. And I speak for a lot of people that couldn't be here at 11:45 on a Monday morning. So thank you for a few extra minutes.
All right. Next up, just feel free to mosey on down if you'd like to make a public comment.
This is not about the reopening of the schools or the guests. I think that whole situation speaks for itself. Not good. I'm here for the 3 of you that are parents, all educators at your heart. And you're also sworn to uphold the state constitution with regards to this town. There's a situation that occurred where a child was harmed that impacted this town. It's still being sat upon. Nobody's done anything. You all know the details. It's time to take some action. It's not going to be pretty. You might have to choose your political crony over a child. And I think I know where all of you will fall on that. Because like I said, you're all decent people. You're all educators. Children need to be protected by the town. It's codified in our state law all over the place. Everything we do should be in the best interest of children. And this being the Education Committee, the time has come. I mean, you've had 6 months of no meeting, so I haven't been able to come and talk to you like this. But you know what the issue is, and it needs to be addressed. It's not going away. The effects are still there, and it has to be addressed. The town needs to take action when a child is impacted by a town official negatively. Thank you.
All right. Anyone else?
okay if I remove my mask?
Yes, you can. Yes, ma'am.
Thank you. Hi, my name is Jessica Ziegler, and I live at 1438 Crane Creek Drive in the Carolina Park neighborhood. Before I say my formal remarks, I just want to say that I agree with my fellow citizens who I believe are going to make an overwhelming comment today that the online education, especially for my kindergartner who's 5 years old, is just not sufficient. But now to my formal remarks. My specific question for the school officials who are here today is, will you follow the World Health Organization and State Department or South Carolina Department of Education guidelines, which exempt children, especially under second grade, from wearing masks? Just recently, on August the 21st, the World Health Organization revised its recommendations to say that children 5 years old and under, which includes my daughter, should not wear masks, and ages 6 to 11, their psychosocial development should be paramount. Also, the South Carolina Department of Education issued their own mask guidelines that state that children second grade and under should be accommodated at any means necessary because they are learning to read, which requires that they see the teacher's face, that they themselves can make the sounds easier, and that they can hear better without the masks, both when they're talking with each other and their teachers. Further, and I hope I don't choke up on this one. Our children have borne the silent burden of this virus. They have lost their schools, they have lost their friends, and yet their development does not stop. 6 months to a five-year-old is a significant portion of her life. When my youngest daughter, when we started this lockdown, she wasn't walking. Now she's walking and running and talking. Their development is different than adults. 6 months to us is no thing, but to them, it is major. And because adults are afraid, they are being asked to bear the burden, and no one is standing up for them. The schools are for our children. They are not for employees to have jobs. They are for our children. Additionally, I have a master's degree in clinical mental health. The fear that masks create among young children is very real. I have seen it in my own children who want to see faces and smiles and not just unfamiliar eyes. So I ask you, Superintendent Postlewaite, to please issue a blanket mask exemption for all children second grade and under so that you will be following not only our own state education guidelines, but the World Health Organization. Thank you.
Thank you. Would anybody else like to come on forward? No.
Good afternoon. My name is John Catlett. I live at 1013 South Shim Drive here in Mount Pleasant. Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today on the behalf of my wife, Annie, my son, Ellis, who's a rising sixth grader at Moultrie Middle School, and my daughter, Carter, a rising 10th grader at the new Lucy Beckham High School. Our children have attended many different schools in Charleston County over the last 10 years. We have seen our children thrive in these schools, and we firmly believe in the value of quality public education. We believe public education gives our children the best opportunity to succeed in the real world. That's why, with such great disappointment and sadness, we received the news on Friday that our children will not be allowed to return to school in person for the unforeseeable future. My heart goes out to all the other families faced with this same disheartening reality. Since Friday, I've spoken with the principals at both Moultrie and Lucy Beckham High School. They were both very straightforward with Annie and I, and I believe that both of these schools are in great hands for the future. I could hear the frustration in their voices that more of their students are not being allowed to return for the start of the year. Also, both principals are frustrated by the decisions that this hybrid model was not pursued further. This was an option that many thought made so much sense, and is very unfortunate that the leadership I stand before today did not pursue this option more. Why was this option not given more credence? I would like to know. My daughter will be part of the first graduating class at Lucy Beckham High School. Why are not more students returning to Lucy Beckham given the size of this school and the low enrollment numbers? This represents a wasted opportunity to me and honestly demonstrates another example of the unwillingness of this board to be more dynamic and show some real leadership. Over the last several months, several anxious months, Annie and I have witnessed a change in both my son Ellis and Carter's behavior. They're moody. They're sometimes withdrawn. They miss their teachers. They miss their friends. The long-term effects of the decisions our administrators are making are neither healthy nor safe for our children. Time won't allow, but there are many studies that prove this to be true. I think we can all agree, at least on some level, that virtual learning failed our children at the end of last year. I realize there have been efforts made to improve this experience, but that's just not good enough. Our children need to be in the classroom, learning in person from a real teacher. They need a teacher pushing them and demanding their best. You are all elected to lead. Regardless of the circumstances you are now faced with, now's the time for bold leadership. I'm pleading with you to reevaluate and reconsider the decisions you've made. Our children deserve better from you. Our children need to be back in the classroom on September 8th. Thank you.
Thank you. Would anybody else like to make a public comment? Going once, going twice. All right. Moving on to item number four, update from Charleston County School District regarding plans for the 2020-2021 school year. And thank you, Dr. Postlewaite and Mr. Barowie for coming to our committee meeting today to give a report on what you guys' plans are. So I will turn the floor over to y'all. I believe you have a presentation queued up.
Yes, do you want us to drive the presentation, advance the slides from here, or someone else?
Mr. DeMar,
may we do that? Is
that
all right?
That? Yes.
Is that all right if we advance slides? Okay, thanks.
Yes.
Yeah.
thank you for inviting us to be here today. It's been a really challenging few months for everyone who's involved in decision making, as I'm sure you all can appreciate. We want to start by sharing with you where sort of the journey our board has been on in trying to make a wise decision. So in mid-July, the COVID rates were very, very high in Charleston County. At one point, we had over 25% testing positive. At one point, we had 959 cases per 100,000. That was in July. So on July 27th, the board made this decision. They voted to delay the start of school from August 18th to September 8th, hoping that the COVID rates would go down. They voted to begin school September 8th, offering both in-person and virtual instruction. They voted to permit somewhere between 20 and 25% of students to return to school and to hold a final decision on whether or not to reopen schools based on whether they saw a downward trend in COVID-19 rates for at least 10 days. So that was the decision that was made at the end of July, given the circumstances that we had at that time. The next slide shows then the impact on the school calendar, because we moved, excuse me, from a start date of August 18th to September 8th. The calendar had to be reconfigured, and the end date will now be June 18th, unless the calendar has to be modified again for some reason. So the board came back on August 10th and saw that there was a downward trend in COVID-19 rates. So on August 10th, they actually gave the district office staff permission to start working with individual principals, as schools saw that they might be able to bring more students back than the 20 to 25%. Schools were given the permission to do that, providing there is a continued trend of decreases of the COVID-19 rates, provided the school had a safe capacity when we did the seating, the spacing of the seating and the plexiglass dividers and all the other safety precautions that had to be taken. The availability of staff to return in phase one, which was rated, in which Charleston County is still rated by DHEC as a high incident, high spread county, and then parent preferences. So that's where we were on August 10th. When the board came back last Monday on the 24th, they saw that COVID-19 rates are significantly declining. We were very close to getting to where we needed to be to get out of the red zone, according to the DHEC ratings. So they were looking at the parent survey return rate at that point. So we have about 33,000 of our 50,000 parents who had responded. And about 51% to 52% of the parents are wanting to return in person. 49% were requesting virtual or some sort of remote, temporary remote instruction. So the board voted to expand the number of seats that will be available on September 28th if our COVID-19 incident rate declines to fewer than 201 per 100,000. So it appears as though all the parents who elect to send students back to school might have the opportunity to do that. And that slide should say September 21st. We actually sent an updated deck, but this is the old deck that was, it had that mistake in it. That should be September 21st if the COVID rates continue to fall. So that's sort of a recap of where our board has been in trying to make a decision about what is the safest given the spread of COVID-19 and the limited knowledge that we have at this time about the spread rates among students, because students, young children, have not been exposed to the disease as much as adults have been exposed in the public. I'm going to turn it over to Jeff Barowe to discuss a few slides, and then we'll come back to an update on where we are specifically with each school.
Thank you. Council members, let me pick up from there and talk a little about some of the documents that this district has put out for both faculty, parents, and the rest of our staff to take a look at to make sure we're on track. The first document that's available is this Safe Restart Implementation Plan. It's posted on our website. It's about a 25-page document, and it incorporates recommendations from MUSC's playbook as well as the guidelines that were presented by Accelerate Ed, South Carolina Accelerate Ed, and DHEC over the course of time. It's a really good document to get a good feel for what is being done from the academic side as well as within the school as far as cleaning protocols and other operational protocols. So it's a very easy to read document. Again, incorporates a lot of the things that the schools are implementing before day one. The next slide, everyone's heard about the MUSC playbook. It has taken us a long time to get to this point. It's not to say that we haven't been using things from that playbook. It's really been the contracting aspect and getting it in a position where MUSC was comfortable with releasing it to the public, and the district was willing to accept the conditions. Their biggest concern was the fact that they were concerned that the document would be used by other entities outside of the school district. And that's, you know, that is intellectual property. It's something that they developed, and they were very concerned about that, and rightfully so. But this document, it's about 150 pages long, roughly. It provides more details. It, in some cases, gives us different options of things to do related to risk mitigation. And then also, they've provided a multi-page checklist for our schools to use, and we're looking at knocking those checklists out here during this week. We've also got the ability to call them back. That's what the concierge service is. If we've got individual questions related to schools and as conditions change, every single day there appears to be different guidance coming out from CDC, DHEC, and we're trying very quickly to absorb that information, talk with the experts, determine if that has to be implemented, what needs to be modified within our current plan. And that, again, is almost a day-to-day concept or day-to-day process. From my world on the operations side, I listed a number of key aspects here, and most of these are risk mitigation measures. I'm very pleased with our Board of Trustees who stepped up to fund a number of these items before we received all of our CARES Act funding and the direction from the superintendent to proceed and implement as much of this as possible. And it has been an entire summer of not only doing our typical summer projects in all of our schools, but to implement these items that are here. Plexiglass, which isn't a fail-safe, but yet another mitigation measure to reduce droplets from being passed between students. In the end, we will have installed 24 miles of plexiglass if we put that plexiglass end-to-end 4 foot high. That is just an idea of how challenging this process has been, but I will tell you that the reaction from the teachers in the schools last week, it really makes them feel a lot more comfortable. We're hopefully we'll have parents have the same reaction when they come back, K through 8 parents come back to visit with their schools this week. Not all schools, not all desks have partitions. If we have a small number of kids in a classroom, clearly spacing could be done to allow for social distancing without having the dividers. We've also made portable partition dividers for all of our teachers, so they'll be able to put that on their desk to meet with a student one-on-one. They'll be able to take that to meetings with them. It's a really good process that was developed by our facility staff. We've got our basic signage complete. The schools are implementing additional signage related to wayfaring and the stand here kind of signs, and that's ongoing right now. From a cleaning perspective, we now have a disinfectant fogger in all of our schools. It's an incredibly good device for disinfecting. It is proven against all viruses. We're looking at doing 25% or 20% of a school each night. These are the same foggers that we've used in our high school locker rooms for years, and there are plenty of studies and TV shows that show the effectiveness of this item. Masks for students and teachers, those were delivered in part last week, and so we have enough in our schools to begin the school year. You know, air filtration and air systems, the HVAC systems, it receives a lot of news. And if you read nationwide information, it really makes schools sound really bad. I will tell you that the funds that this district has used to maintain our systems has been phenomenal, in part due to the sales tax program, which has been highly effective in recapitalizing our aging systems. We are in really good shape for both quality of filters, fresh air systems. We're going to be turning those systems on earlier, and we put HEPA filters in all of our nurses' clinics. We feel very comfortable with how our schools stand. When folks say, why don't we open doors and windows, that's why we have fresh air systems. We have fresh air systems to cycle out air 6 times in every classroom in an hour. That allows us to treat that air coming in so that we don't end up with mold in our schools. And so we just don't want to open up the windows and doors. We've got these fantastic systems in our schools. And then lastly, we've turned off all of our drinking fountains, and we now have bottle fillers in all of our schools to allow for a more safe getting of water from our kids and our faculty. Moving on, I've got a couple of slides here on common questions. I get a lot of these from parents and faculties about what happens if a child or a faculty member is positive. And let me just open by saying, our nursing services team, we are blessed to have over 100 nurses in our schools. And we've gone through a significant process this past spring working with DHEC to do contact tracing. DHEC fully trusts our school district to do that. We get it done extremely effective. In most cases, in 2 to 3 hours, whenever we've had a positive case. But our process is essentially that once notified, nursing services will assign a nurse to do the contact tracing. We'll identify those individuals that have to be quarantined, either because if they were the one that was positive or the fact that they were deemed to be a close contact, they're told to quarantine. And then we notify communications, and I'll talk a little bit about the information that will be passed to public here shortly. Our facilities management department then cleans the respective areas, and we move on. Next slide is, again, a common question I get. So when will a school have to close if there are positive cases? And it's, I hate to say it depends, but it really does depend. And you see the number of factors that are listed there, including the number of cases a school has, the distribution within a school, and the timing of those cases. We'll clearly be working with the DHEC epidemiology teams on whether or not groups need to be closed. We could look at closing a classroom. We could look at closing a wing before we close an entire school. But that is one decision that's left up to the district, but we'll be working hand in hand with our medical experts to make that determination. The dashboard, we're going to have that up and running before school starts next week. And that dashboard will be a very quick and easy place for parents to see what is happening across the district. In addition to the links of other reports and other documents which carry metrics, we're going to have two key items on that screen, and Dr. Postlewaite will cover that a couple slides from now, but I do want to talk a little bit about that. It'll include the data on the three metrics that we are tracking, the incidence rate, the trend of the incidence rate, and the positivity rate in Charleston County, and then we'll have the school data. So if there are positive cases at a school, we'll indicate the number of cases on each given day and the summation from the previous week so the parent can see where things might be heading with their individual school. If the school is not listed, that means that there's no case that's occurred. But at this point, we don't intend to call every single parent in a school if there is a positive case, only those that are close contacts, which is the requirement from DHEC.
Mr. Rambo, can I ask a question?
Yeah.
When you say close contact, what is, I mean, if it's a kindergarten class with 15 kids in it, wouldn't, if one kid in the class tests positive, wouldn't close contact be that entire class? Or
not necessarily. So the nurse will interview the teacher, and in most cases talk with students, maybe not necessarily kindergartners, but if it happens in an older class, with the dividers, with the small number of kids in class, if they're spread out, the definition of close contact is within 6 feet for 15 minutes. That is the guideline that's used by everybody. And so if you have a child that's across the room and is never within 6 foot of the other student the entire day, that child would not be a close contact in that type of a scenario. So each case has to be reviewed on a case-by-case basis.
Okay.
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you.
Yep. Last slide I've got, and I'll turn it back over to Dr. Postlewaite, is the face coverings. I heard the young lady mention WHO. We will guide off of CDC, DHEC, and the MUSC epidemiology teams. Currently, that does not go down to second grade. It goes below that for children that have to wear the masks. We will continue to monitor that. If there's additional guidance provided, we'll ask those experts what they think, and we'll adjust accordingly. But right now, it's 2 years old and under that don't need to wear a mask. If certain kids can't wear a mask because of medical reasons, they can submit a request for a medical waiver. That's where it stands right now.
Can I ask a question about that? Can parents go off of the young lady's concern? Can parents opt out of a mask, or is it they have to prove a medical reason? Or
as it stands right now, that is the case, because
okay.
The mask protects others, not yourself. So my mask is protecting you. And so the concern is very different than any other protocols we've implemented. What the guidance is actually to protect others.
Yeah.
And so that's the challenge we have with face coverings. Right now, the medical waiver, which is this close to being implemented, we're almost done with it. It will be a medical requirement at this point. Again, we will continue to monitor and review all data that's out there to see if we can change that. Because we certainly, we have instances, there will be examples where, the example for a medical waiver right now is in our special needs population. If a child cannot take their own mask off, no matter what age they are, if they can't take their own mask off, they're not gonna have to wear a mask. And that's in alignment, again, with the guidance that we've received from our medical providers.
Okay. And for those parents who are interested in that, is that as simple as, you know, obtaining a doctor's note basically saying that they don't have to wear one, or that their doctor, their pediatrician does not recommend it, or something of that nature?
I don't know the extent at this point. It's being developed, and we'll have that published shortly. I think it's going to be rolled out to principals later on today, is my understanding, to take a look at that requirement. So we haven't published it yet.
Okay.
So moving back then to the discussion of no one asked about temporary or virtual today. I'll go over this slide anyway. We have a lot more parents select temporary remote than we expected. We're trying to figure out from parents whether they want a long-term enrollment in a virtual option or a more temporary enrollment option so that their child can ease back into in-person instruction sometime during this school year. So we're trying to look at it for high school students as semester by semester. The difference is in the virtual academy, many of the courses are purchased and they're pre-recorded. So the advantage is you could watch them any time of the day. The disadvantage is if you need help, there may not be a real live human being to get help from. The temporary remote is the kind of instruction that's received from the classroom teacher, and the classroom teachers obviously have had a lot more time to get organized, to be trained. The state has provided a better learning management system for us to use. The district has had an opportunity to work with teachers. Teachers have come to school, work with one another to make sure that their schedules are much more coordinated. None of us, however, would put forth the proposition that learning virtually is better than learning in person. Learning in person is the best option for any child. There was a question about the hybrid schedule and AABB schedule. There was a question about the hybrid schedule.
The microphone's off. There we go.
Well, is that helpful?
Yes.
Yeah. Thank you, and I apologize. Where should I back up to? I will simply say that the, let's see, the slide before this one was just, okay, so the difference between virtual school and temporary remote is that in virtual schools, some of the courses are pre-recorded. They are from excellent instructors, but they're pre-recorded. They're not necessarily Charleston County Schools instructors, although some of them will be. The temporary remote, a child is assigned to a teacher, hopefully a teacher that's affiliated with that child's school, so that if there's a phase into in-person instruction, there will be some affiliation with a teacher who's on the team or at least in that school. I was talking about the question regarding hybrid schedules, AABB, and the answer is this, that virtual instruction is the least effective instruction for children. In-person instruction is the most effective instruction for children, and virtual sits somewhere in between. So if we can't get children in for 5 days a week, obviously we would prefer to get them in for at least 2 or 3 days a week. If we move everyone to 2 or 3 days a week, that really disfavors parents from whom you heard earlier in the public comments. If there's a couple who both work, or a single parent family and the parent works, that sort of Monday, Tuesday, 1 week, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, the next week, is very difficult to arrange babysitters, to arrange a tutor to be in the home for the off days and so forth. So our ideal plan is for those who want to return in person 5 days a week. If we can't manage that, then we will revert to some sort of hybrid AABB schedule. And we're working now to try to make sure that we understand which parents want a temporary virtual and a long-term virtual delivery so that we can sort all of that out. We've had surveys ongoing since July. The surveys, we've over-surveyed parents in some instances and under-surveyed in others, but as the data regarding COVID-19 and the choices become clearer to us, then we're reaching out to parents again, and that's what schools are doing now, reaching every household, trying to make sure they understand exactly who wants what. This slide shows you an example of the variation among schools across the district. The first column shows the name of a few of our schools. The second column shows the safe seating capacity that can be achieved in the building once the distancing of the seats and or the plexiglass dividers have been put in place. The third and fourth columns show the student requests, the number who want in person and the number who want online. The fourth column shows teacher preferences. We showed the teacher preference column because I think there's a misconception that the reason children can't come back in person is because teachers didn't want to come back in person, and that's simply not the case. We have far more teachers willing to come back and teach children in person than we have across the district. Parents who are comfortable sending their children back at this time. There are a couple of schools where that's an exception, and that is likely due to the age of the teachers or some conditions those teachers may have. But at any rate, this chart shows you that at Academic Magnet High School, for example, we have 423 students wanting to come back in person. We don't yet have capacity to bring that many students back. Ellington Elementary, they've made room for all of their students. Only 57 want to come back in person. Camp Road, we're close enough. We think we can probably work all the students in who want to come in Camp Road. Jenny Moore is a school where we have 528 students wanting to come back in person. There's seating for over 1,000. So just as quickly as we can get a couple of weeks in, make sure we understand how to start safely, we have every reason to believe we'll begin phasing in more students in person in that school. And then the final example is from Military Magnet. That's just the opposite of Academic Magnet, where we have seating for far more students than who want to return safely. So this shows the Mount Pleasant Elementary Schools, what we're looking at here. Across the district, we have about 80 schools. In 30 of those 80 schools, we have more parents wanting to return in person than we can serve in person at least the first 2 weeks of school. 12 of those schools are in the Mount Pleasant area. So this shows you the safe seating capacity for each of the schools in Mount Pleasant, the number of parents who are requesting to have their children come back in person, the teacher preferences. That doesn't mean that that's what all teachers will get to do. Some of that, teachers are still filing medical reports or filing exemptions, so that isn't complete yet. It would be our preference in phase one, when COVID rates are still high, to allow teachers who want to teach virtually to teach virtually, to match them up with the parents who want their children to learn virtually. But that's not a board policy by any means. It is, however, a commitment that the district administration made to teachers in terms of our willingness to try to work with everyone, so that we're not asking someone to work with children in person if they're very uncomfortable doing that. And again, I think we have plenty of supply of teachers willing to work with children in person, that won't be a holdup at all. It's just a matter of making sure that we start safely for a couple of weeks, and then bring back the rest of the kids who want to come back, whose parents want them to come back in person.
I have a question back on the elementary school slides. So when you say COVID safe seating capacity, that means that there's been plexiglass put up and the desks are arranged properly. Is that correct?
Right, in its easiest sense. So it's looking at 6-foot spacing between any seat unless there is a divider.
But if these capacities are so large compared, like for the majority of the schools, like for example, Bell Hall, you've got 700 and only 435 want to come back, why aren't those 435 being allowed to come back?
Right. So we're going to get to that in the presentation to show you where Charleston County stands in terms of the ratings that the state put in place for bringing children back safely. This slide shows the Mount Pleasant Middle and High Schools. Again, you can see that we're not going to have difficulty bringing everyone back when it's safe to do that. We don't see any schools where we're going to have a problem, given the number who've currently asked to come back in person. Now, I will say that as of Friday, we had heard from at least in the power school system that we use, we'd heard from about 34,000 children. There are still a few thousand, 10,000-12,000 more children whose information may be known at the school level, but it hasn't been entered into power school. Again, principals, teachers are still contacting every household to make sure they understand precisely what children want to do. The position we have taken is that if you registered your child, you're already in the roster, you've been notified your child's on a waiting list, then you're first on the waiting list to come back when we open up more seats. Even though we may still have some additional parents who want to come back, we may eventually reach those capacities, but we're not at them right now with the number of parents who've indicated they want their children to come back in person at this time. So we monitor the MUSC COVID-19 Epidemiology Intelligence Report. The information is there for anyone who wants to look at it. They actually have 8 indicators that they follow, and each of those 8 indicators is broken down into some sub-indicators. The two that we're in the red on for MUSC are the number of reported infections per 10,000 in our population. So our COVID-19 rate in Charleston County is still higher than medical officials want it to be in order for us to be out and moving about safely. Let me be clear, MUSC has not taken any position on whether or not to open schools. They simply show these data. The other thing that's concerning is the speed of the diagnostic testing and the return of the results is still too slow in our area. So we're not getting results back in as quickly as we would like to get them back. There's also one other metric that's red on MUSC's report. It has to do with super spreader events. Those are in nursing homes, and so we didn't show that one on this slide. So here we come to the metrics that are established by DHEC and were recommended by the Accelerate Ed Task Force. So DHEC, as Jeff mentioned, talks about three metrics, and they caution in the DHEC report that these metrics are not to be used in isolation of other factors. But the three criteria that DHEC tracks are the two-week incident rate, is it low, medium, or high, the average two-week incident rate per 100,000 people in a county, the trend in the incident rate, is it going up, going down, or staying the same? And the percent positive, is that a low, a medium, or a high percentage? The Accelerate Ed recommendations that came out of the state task force then are normal operations if it's low or no spread. Some students back, they actually use the word hybrid if there's medium spread. But because about half of our parents want students in back and half at home, we'd like to define hybrid as meaning half want to come back and we could bring that half back 5 days a week. We think if we can open safely for a couple of weeks and make sure we've got the right protocols in place. The virtual learning would be used anytime there's a high spread of COVID-19. And then the other part of the Accelerate Ed recommendation is in italics there, and there are high numbers of positive cases within the school building, which of course we don't have because we haven't been open. So this is what our dashboard looks like for Charleston County. Our metrics, when we look at the two-week incident rate, we are over 201 per 100,000. Last Monday we were sitting at 238. I mentioned we have been as high as this, the footnote here says 941. We looked that up again on Friday and it was 959 was the highest. So we've come down a lot, but we're still over what DHEC would need to take us out of the red zone on the first indicator. The second indicator is the trend in two-week incident rate. We are coming down, so we're rated low in that indicator. On the third, the percent of positive tests, we sat at 13.8% positive on the two-week average as of last Monday. We have to get that under 10% to get out of that high range for Charleston County. We expect to see another set of DHEC ratings at the end of today. We don't have any reason to believe we're going to move out of the red on those two indicators. So according to DHEC, if you're in the red on two of three indicators, then your rating as a county is red, and that makes you high incident rate. So if you back up to the previous slide, a high spread of COVID-19, virtual learning only is recommended. So our board has already said we want to start back at least 25% of our children on July 27th. They voted on that. On August 10th, they said school by school, principals can go higher than that if they feel they can do it safely. And then as of the 24th of August, our board took a slightly different vote, which is even more favorable for bringing children back. So this shows the decline in the COVID-19 incident rates. We've gone down 75%. If we put Charleston, Berkeley, and Dorchester counties together, we are at that 200 per 100,000, but Charleston County itself is not. We're still over. You can see from this chart how rapidly our incident rate has been declining. That rate of decline has fallen off You probably saw in the paper that our daily rate was really high again. And again, these are two-week averages, rolling two-week averages. So we're headed in a very promising direction, but we're not quite there yet. So on August 24th, the board voted to increase to around 50% the total enrollment of students across the district. That's not 50% at each school, it's across the district. 50% who could attend in person by September 21st, providing the COVID-19 rates continue to fall. And again, that metric is fewer than 201 cases per 100,000. So here's where we are. As of August 26th, 17,600 students went in person and 16,200 went online. There's an update in those data for August 28th, but the ratios don't change. So as of August 26th, we had 14,000 parents hadn't expressed a preference. And we anticipate that on August 21st, we will be able to provide in-person instruction to all the students whose parents have currently asked for that option if the COVID-19 incident rates continue to decline. Our board will have to decide whether or not they're willing to go further than that if we're not within the DHEC ranges of medium spread out of the high spread range. So for all parents who want online instruction, our district is committed to providing that for the entire rest of the year. That won't be any problem. And as rates go down, hopefully over the next few weeks and months, we're willing to bring back more students if their parents would like that. So that's really where we are. We can't promise that we can bring back every child whose parent is in the queue wanting to come back by the 21st of September, but it's our hope that after we've started for 9 days with this smaller percentage of students who are coming back on Tuesday, if things have worked out successfully and the protocols are working, that following Monday we will be able to return to every school in the district the students who are currently in the queue requesting in-person instruction. So we hope we've addressed most of the questions. We're happy to try our best to respond to any other concerns or questions.
Ms. Corley.
Thank you, Dr. Postlewaite, for coming in and sharing that information. I'm curious, I didn't get to listen to the board meeting when you guys held it, but what was the thinking behind looking at district-wide numbers versus school-based numbers? Because as Councilwoman Whitley said, the numbers seem quite kind of drastic, you know, how many seats available versus enrollment. So what was the thinking behind looking at district numbers instead of school numbers?
I think that the thinking was to try to give as many parents and students who want to come back in person the option to do that as the district could. I'll give you a couple examples. We have a middle school that can seat 800 some students. 20 parents want to come back in person in that school. So opening up 50% of the seats in that school doesn't make any sense. However, here in Mount Pleasant, we have schools where 85% of the parents want to come back in person. If we believe we can seat them safely, the board's intent was not to keep a school that wanted to, where a large percentage of parents wanted to have their children to come back. Without disadvantaging students in another part of the district. So they were trying to say, we need to stay inside of some sort of guidelines. So district-wide, if we have 50,000 students, we think we could bring 25,000 back safely. It's an imperfect science. Yeah. It's a challenging time. Decision-making is difficult for everyone, and I can't speak for our board, but it was my impression that they were trying to create as much flexibility as possible.
Were school leaders a part of those conversations? Because it seems like those are not very school-specific issues, I would think. I'm still having a hard time comprehending the district-wide versus, and it sounds to me as though the board really wants and most of these kids are going to be able to come back on the 21st, looking at how many spaces available per school and kids that want to come back. So, I mean, I think when you speak it, it sounds a little bit more negative than when you look at it. You know, when you see it on paper, it looks like it's going to happen. It's just the spoken word. And then one more question. What's the transition? Like, what's y'all's plan? Because let's say 25% come back on the 8th, and then the 75 others come back 2 weeks later. So the district is encouraging schools to have a transition, because what are those 25% going to do? Because when the 75 come back, instruction is going to start all over, or are they going to be working on a different virtual cohort than the kids that choose to go virtual altogether?
Right. So this won't be a normal year in any sense of the word. And there will be times when students have to make transitions. And sometimes they'll be able to come back. Their teacher will be teaching them virtually. They'll have that same teacher when they come back to school. But that won't always be the case.
Right.
Sometimes there will be times when students come back, it will be like moving from one school to another. They will recognize some of the students who are in their classroom, but there will be a redistribution of students. That's the only way we could possibly manage all the change that has to occur. And you asked a question a little bit ago that is a really important question. You asked if principals have been involved in the
Yes.
conversations every step of the way, and the answer is no. Sometimes they have and sometimes they haven't. It's been very difficult for the board to know what to do, and there are times when principals are given advance notice and have an opportunity to have some input, and there have been a couple of times where principals have been a little surprised by the decisions that have been made and have scrambled to do the best that they can to respond as quickly as they can. So we're trying now to make sure that we're on a steady and even path now that we understand the metrics that the board is using. We weren't able to bring to the board any clear recommendations on the metrics. So I would say it's a matter of 9 different publicly elected officials using the best information that we could provide to them, trying to make the wisest decisions that they could. It hasn't been perfect. And in our next pandemic, we will do some things differently. But I believe that I heard someone say, I think in the audience, that not all of the children would be able to come back the 21st. And I hope that we can have a conversation about that, because we don't know any reason why all the students who are currently in the queue would not be able to come back on the 21st.
Hold on, guys. If you'll please not comment from the gallery.
And
Thank
that
you.
Makes sense, the fact that school leaders haven't been a part of this process, kind of explains to me anyway why the why it looks the way it looks. And then one more, and then I'll be quiet, I promise. The teacher, what has been the so each school has a plan for what's going to happen if this many teachers have to be quarantined, and what's the substitute ratio looking like? Do you guys feel good about the amount of substitutes available?
No, Bill Brigman, who heads the HR department, feels as good as anyone can feel at this point in time. He and his staff have been working for many weeks to line up as many substitutes as possible, and the substitutes have been trained to step in either virtually or in person. So they've been trained on both platforms. We have, surprisingly, hundreds of substitutes who say they are willing to come back.
Yes.
Some substitutes, depending on the size of the school, every school will have at least one full-time substitute assigned to that school. Other very large schools will have multiple substitutes assigned only to that school, so that we don't have substitutes going from school to school to school to try to prevent the spread of the disease. It's just every single time we think we have found a simple answer, it turns out to be a lot more complex than anyone thought. I think we understand fairly well parents' frustrations, and we're willing to work with anyone to try to resolve the problems, but it's been slow going. Principals have been just remarkable. Teachers have been very responsive as well.
So I guess a lot of the concerns have to do with how the a lot of the concerns that I've heard from people have to do with how these 25% were chosen. And we understand that there are students with special needs and that sort of thing. But then, you know, a lot of people felt there was a lack of transparency with kind of the Hunger Games style lottery that was put in place to kind of determine who else was able to fill those seats. And so one of the concerns that I've heard quite a bit is, let's say we hit the numbers and everybody who wants in-person gets to go back on September 21st. Well, let's say 3 or 4 weeks later, our cases go way up and we have to go back to 25%. Is it then those same parents who lost out the first time that then have to, their kids have to go back virtually, but then the other kids who had been there the whole time get to stay in person? Like, what happens with that, or what's kind of the pre-planning there?
Yeah, that's really a good question. Once we open up, you don't go backwards on the chart. So once the school is open and your child is in, COVID-19 cases are considered on a classroom by classroom, wing by wing, school by school basis. So there's no reverting back to phase one. Once you're in phase two, you're in phase two.
Okay.
Once you're in phase three, you're in phase three. And the decisions are made on a case by case basis, per classroom, per hallway, per wing, per school.
Gotcha. Okay, and so what was the thought process behind, I know other school districts like Greenville, for instance, their 25% means that every kid goes one day a week and then they're virtual the rest, so it's kind of there's kind of an equality deal. And when they go to 50%, that means every kid goes 2 days a week or what have you. What was the rationale for not going, what was the discussion with the board as far as not going that method, as far as going to the method where some kids get full 5 days and other people don't get to go at all?
The discussion was, given the steep decline in COVID-19 rates, the hope is that all of the students who want to come back can come back 5 days a week. The concern about, and we may end up going to an ABC schedule, but the concern is that it's not as instructionally sound as 5 days a week, if we can pull off 5 days a week. And for working parents, it's really difficult to plan ahead and to get a sitter. If your child's in school, you're not giving someone a full-time job. You're giving them a part-time job with rotating days. And if children are dropped at daycare centers, children themselves then are still getting the same or perhaps more exposure than they would have gotten had they been in a controlled environment. So the hope, we may go to a hybrid schedule with some students on some days and some off, but our board's objective is to bring all children back 5 days a week as quickly as possible, given that half of our parents, only half of our parents, 51-52%, want 5 days a week. That in itself creates a hybrid. It's the same thing as an AB schedule with 100% coming back.
Understood.
So the objective was the higher road of trying to give as many students as possible 5 days a week. That may not work, and we may have to back up and go to a hybrid.
Okay. Have there been any thoughts regarding treating elementary schools different than, say, middle and high schools? I know that other countries have done that and done that successfully. And if you think, you know, you can, an 11th grader can pretty much do an online class, but there's really no such thing as online first grade. It just doesn't. It's just not real.
Right.
So has there been any thoughts to not treating all K-12 schools the exact same and prioritizing the younger kids? And then I know a lot of parents here who have to work, and you know, your high schooler again can stay home by themselves, but the second grader can't.
Right.
So I just wanted to know if there had been any discussion involved with that.
So you mentioned the criteria for deciding which students come back in person. Pre-K-1-2 students were given priority among those who came back in person to start with. And if for any reason we're unable to bring all of the students back to an elementary school, we might use space available in a building that is intended for older students in order to bring all elementary students back. So yes, those kinds of conversations are occurring.
Okay. Okay. And then finally, I guess, you know, historically in Charleston, as we both know very well, you know, there's been a large achievement gap between our wealthy students and our not wealthy students. So private schools seem to have all gone back in person. So there's a large fear that our wealthy kids are essentially getting the high quality in-person instruction, and our more disadvantaged students, or our working parents or that sort of thing, are not. And so has there been discussions as far as, you know, the worry of just increasing that generational achievement gap by leaps and bounds?
I think that's probably, other than safety, that's our number one concern. Not all students, not all private schools are back in person 5 days a week, but several are. And it's certainly true if you want to enroll your child in a private school for 5 days a week. Chances are you can find that option. So we have two concerns. One is that we need to get all of our children back in school 5 days a week as quickly as possible. And a trend, although I cannot say for certain because we don't have the registrations for all of our students, but the trend seems to be that among those who prefer virtual instruction are children who come from impoverished families where healthcare may not be as readily accessible, where there may be more people living in a household, where there may be multi-generational family members as part of the household. There are a multitude of reasons we could, or theories we could give for why that is. And those are often the households who are unable to connect as well virtually as other households. So a tremendous amount of work has been done in that arena. Just as soon as we can get all the students back to school who want to come in person, our next big challenge is to try to set up learning pods in the neighborhoods where clusters, large clusters of youngsters, parents have chosen for them to learn virtually, because we don't think they'll learn well without those supports. So we're working with philanthropic and faith-based groups now to try to set that up. But you're absolutely right. That's a concern not only locally, but nationally.
I had a couple questions about, for those families that have chosen to be virtual for through the year or for an extended period of time, for the higher level, like especially students in critical years like junior year of high school, or how are you going to maintain academic integrity with testing? Because if you're a virtual student and you're sitting there with your, you know, is there any way to monitor? You're looking at your textbook, you're getting text messages from friends on the phone as you're taking these exams, versus someone in person who wouldn't necessarily be able to. I mean, how are you going to address that?
Well, for the virtual academy students at the high school level, there's an attempt to enroll all students who are learning virtually in a purchased program that's been tried and succeeded and been shown to have the same kind of instructional integrity. I don't think there's ever any way to ensure that a student who's taking a test in person is going to have the same test security as a student who's taking the test at home. I don't know any way to ever ensure that that would be the case, and so I wouldn't want to try to speak to it otherwise.
And then the other question I had is for the elementary age. So just as an example, I've got four kids in public school, and I'm not concerned about my older two. Like Councilman Rambo said, they're old enough to where they can log themselves in, and they can, you know, I work from home, they can log themselves in and out. But I received a sample schedule for what online school is going to look like for the younger ages. And when I mentioned the schedule to my third graders, they just about started bawling, because it was 20 minutes instruction online, 30-minute independent activity, 20-minute instruction online, 30-minute independent activity, kind of rotated for 7 hours throughout the day with like a break for lunch. And I looked at that schedule and just thought, how is this feasible for any working parent to monitor and to help? Like, is this independent activity something they're going to be doing on their computer? So they're going to have 7 hours of screen time? Is it something that I'm going to have to print something every 5 minutes for them to do and like help them log in? So is there a program, or is there something that allows, I mean, I'm perfectly fine being physically home so that I'm and working from home while my child, I mean, I'm very fortunate that I can do that. But this whole schedule just seems to be required, like, each family needs like a person to monitor this and log this on and off, and that just seems cost prohibitive for so many families, and then also just awful for the children. I guess trying to do remote instruction just like in-person instruction just seems to me to not be pedagogically, I mean, I'm not an educator, but just, it doesn't make sense to me. So is that something they're wedded to? Are they going to see if it works? I mean, if kids just drop out and stop showing up because they can't get themselves in and out and in and out and in and out of these programs, you know, what's that going to look like?
So I don't know what it will ultimately look like, because we'll continue to modify it until we get it to a good place for teachers and students. The complaints from last spring were that the schedules were not structured enough. The district hadn't provided adequate training to teachers. We learned on a Sunday afternoon that we were closing. Students didn't come back to school except to pick up whatever devices they might have had available at that time, and parents weren't trained to turn on the devices or do anything else. My understanding is that in an effort to try to ameliorate some of those complaints, there is greater structure to start with. That structure will be modified as necessary, and most of the independent work is done on the device. And so the teacher can see immediately if the student is getting the work right or wrong. There will be some kinds of writing assignments that, again, that can be done on the device. There will sometimes be reading assignments. Whether or not the reading comprehension is checked by responding to questions online or in a discussion with teachers, I don't know. This would be a good discussion topic for the group to have with Carolyn Belcher, who's the chief academic officer and knows a whole lot more about this than I. What I can tell you is she's gone to great lengths to follow national models from the best virtual delivery that was available for purchase. I believe the investment was a little over $4 million to try to make sure that whatever it is that we're providing is best in class.
And that's going to be for the virtual academy, but what about the kids that are, like, I opted for in-person and I wasn't in the 25%, so now I'm temporary remote.
That's for both virtual and temporary remote. It's for both. At the elementary school, the virtual classes are the ones that are often delivered asynchronously and are taped ahead of time. At the elementary level, that's rarely appropriate except for just in unusual circumstances for children. So all the teachers have been given as much training as we could get done in the days available that are paid days. This week there are 5 additional days for teachers to meet with parents and students if they're in PK through 8, and we're going to start the year in the best position we can possibly be in. But again, there is no way that virtual learning can ever be set up to be as effective as in-person learning. So all I can tell you is we've taken the best advice we could find from best practice, from national providers. We've structured a day in a way that seems to make sense based on the feedback that we've been given. But we absolutely know we're going to have to continually modify and adjust.
So this is just me as an individual speaking, but I feel like overall in our society, we've just become so hyper-focused on COVID and coronavirus that we've kind of lost sight of kind of the big picture. And our kids really have taken the brunt of this. They've lost out a good bit of their childhood. They've lost out on their friends and their sports and their school and their development. And I'm very worried about the long-term impacts of this on them. I'm very worried about their mental health. As we pre-COVID, we're already seeing so many rises in mental health issues in our children. And I can't even imagine some of the situations that our kids are living in without any breaks for the past 6 months. And so I feel, again, just me speaking, that it is vitally important that we get these kids back in school. So thank you again for coming, and we really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks.
We have number five. We have one more item.
Oh, we do. Oops, sorry.
All right. So we will now move on to item number five, discussion of the Mount Pleasant Youth Council. Thank you again, Dr. Postaway and Mr. Barabi, for coming.
Thank you. Good seeing you again.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, guys.
Good afternoon. I will go ahead and jump right into Youth Council and give you a brief update on where we are. Unfortunately, COVID did affect our first session, which was already going to be a shortened session of 6 months since we started in January. I'll go through the priorities here, because one thing that council made very clear when they approved this new body was that they wanted the teens to be able to work on subject matters and projects that were important to them. And so at the very first meeting, they went through and they identified the priorities that they wanted to work on. And they're listed up here above for you, as well as some of the, I guess, the brief amount of work that we were actually able to get done. I've highlighted teen mental health initiatives. It's interesting that you just mentioned that, Councilmember Rambo, because that was their top priority, followed closely by teen drug use. And so we were able to get them involved in the Our Community, Our Children event that happened this past year. And I'll tell you, it's the first time they were obviously involved, and they stole the show. So much so that we've met with the head of that program and are fully expecting them to have an even bigger and more involved role in the coming year. You can see some of the things that they've listed up here. Charity events, social media page for teens in Mount Pleasant to know what's going on around town. That is complete. The social media page is actually entirely operated by the Youth Council members and monitored by staff. And they have done a great job of highlighting their members, making sure that the information is out there when they were still in session. And I fully expect that to be back up and operational as they move into the start of their new session, which is this September. Martina, if you'll advance for me, please. So the 2020-2021 session, it does coincide with the school year that was designed on purpose. So this year will be September through June. Virtual meetings will be used if needed, although we do hope to be able to meet in person with safety protocols in place. So originally there were 12 members. One of them graduated this past year, and we felt that since this group of teens did not really get an opportunity to get off the ground and really work, we extended the opportunity for them to come back for this year if they so chose, and all of them readily agreed. So we're just going to operate with 11 members this year. They range from sophomore to seniors, for a variety of different schools here in the Lowcountry, including homeschooling. And they're going to pick back up on the priorities from last year, and they're also going to vote on if there's any new priorities that they'd like to accomplish this year. As I said, we expect them to have a more significant role in the Our Community, Our Children event. Actually, I've just been contacted by an organization last week who's willing to partner with them on the cultural fair, which I think will be a really exciting and unique event for the town of Mount Pleasant. So we look to see that coming forward in 2021. But if there's any specific questions that you have about the Youth Council and what they will be working on, how they'll be set up, I'd be happy to answer them for you.
Yeah, so I just kind of wanted to get an update. I know they were, that we had gotten them established in maybe January or February, and
correct.
Then they had maybe one or two meetings, and then it didn't really happen. So I wasn't sure, what was going on with that. So do they have their first meeting scheduled for September, you said?
They do, yes. It's always okay. The third Thursday of the month, aside from 2 months where we had to kind of shift based on holidays and things. But it's always the third Thursday of the month here at Town Hall, unless, of course, virtual meetings are necessary. But you're correct. They did meet for two meetings the last session, then yeah. COVID hit. And they're all in a group text message, so they still interact and talk throughout, which is really interesting and fun to just kind of observe. So they're still working. They're ready to get back to work and very anxious to accomplish some of their other priorities. So I think it'll be a great and very successful year for them.
Very cool. And with that, I guess, were there any graduating seniors that were on that? And did they automatically roll off, or they're still on that? How does that work?
We had one graduating senior, and the Youth Council recognized her when she graduated. So they roll off at that point.
Okay.
And because of this year, again, since we invited them, the former members, the ones who were not graduating seniors, to return,
yeah.
They would come back up But typically, how we would expect this to operate is that every year you would go back through the application process, just to make sure that we're continuing, opening that opportunity to students. We did have quite a surprising number of applications the first time around, and I think as they gain more traction and schools recognize what this body is, that we'll see quite a few more of those come through.
So would our goal be then to put out applications for, say, the next year, like in the spring? And
correct.
So then they're elected in the spring, and then they start in September and just
correct.
Kind of,
yes.
Okay.
So the goal is to put the applications out in late spring, be able to conduct the interviews in the summertime when they're all free, and then they would start with the start of the school year every year, and then the session would coincide with the school year.
Okay, perfect. And then the other thing, I know I mentioned this, I think back in February, right before we got shut down, but just for maybe if we have an education meeting every 2 months, that one or two of them could come and just kind of talk about what they're doing and sure. and how we could assist them with that. And we could certainly have the education meeting first thing in the morning, so that way they can get to school if they're allowed to go.
Yeah, absolutely.
Anybody else? All right. Thank you very much.
Okay.
And that just brings us to adjournment. Thank you, everyone.
Big brown.